Okay, so when we think about the story of the Megillah, and certainly, if you would ask your child, or if you would go to, the classic Purim play, so the story goes as follows, right? Haman came to, wanted to destroy the Jewish people. He got Ahasuerus's permission. At some point, Esther tried to intercede. Esther got Haman and Ahasuerus together. Haman seemed to go after Esther, Esther got up and said that Haman is the one who's trying to kill me and my people. And Ahasuerus says, Gewalt, I can't believe that he would do such a thing, and decides at that point that he's going to kill Haman. After the death of Haman, Bnei Yisrael is thrilled, and everybody has a big party, and they establish a holiday that's going to last for the rest of time. What did I leave out of that story? Did I leave anything important out? I mean, anything like in the total ups and downs of the story. I know there's obviously details I left out. Right?
I was thinking of Mordechai's actions about the two of them that resulted in him being led through the...
Okay.
Which resulted in Haman being...
Right. Okay, that's setting the stage. Right. The death of Vashti and the choice of Esther and Mordechai telling Esther that... this thing happened and getting his name written down, right? All of that happened. I'm looking at today in theory is supposed to be a shiur on the 8th chapter of Megillah, of the Megillah, and at what point? And I'm looking for a what's absent at the end of the story, right? We think about it. Haman dies, and everybody celebrates, right?
The war that they had.
So there's this war thing, right? There's this war thing. Now, the war thing, so when is it that Bnei Yisrael celebrates, right? What's the most famous celebratory pasuk, the most celebratory verse of the Megillah is, maybe you disagree, but I think it's La'yehudim ha'isa'or v'simcha v'sason v'yikar, right? That all the Jews were thrilled and they danced, etc., and everybody was happy, right? That pasuk is in the 8th chapter, which we're going to read today, which we're going to learn now. The battle, the fight for the war, right, the fight for Jews to defend themselves doesn't take place till the 9th chapter, right? So Bnei Yisrael's thrilled and happy and excited before the war is actually fought. Okay, that's one thing to just think about in terms of the chronology of the story. Mm-hmm. Another issue, big issue with the chronology of the story, is that there are some dating issues. Not dating in terms, there are dating issues of in the Megillah as well, but in terms of just the dates of when things took place. I'm not talking about the year, I'm talking about the date, right? When is it that Esther fasted and appeared in front of Ahasuerus? When did that happen, roughly? So that happens over the Pesach holiday. That happens in Nisan. And I'm not just making, this isn't like Midrashim, etc. This is in the text of the Megillah. It gives you dates, right? Oh, hello, David. Wow. Right? So the Megillah itself records dates. And the story of Esther appearing in front of Ahasuerus, right, that happens during Nisan, over the Pesach holiday. And the fast of Tanis Esther, when Esther asks everybody to fast for 3 days, that takes place during Nisan. In fact, Seder night, they fasted. They did not have a Seder that year. And there's all sorts of interesting things about that. And Haman dies, it sounds like, over Pesach. In fact, in the verses that we at the very end of the Seder, when we talk about the Vayhi b'chatzi halayla, right, it mentions the Purim story because that took place actually over Pesach. Okay, when the pasuk of La Yehudim Haisa Orav V'Simcha V'Sasun V'Yikar, that the Jews were all happy and excited. When does that take place? What is the date of that? So we're going to see it's actually in Sivan, the end of Sivan. Shavuos, that's June time, right? Shavuos is the beginning of Sivan. And this was at the end of Sivan. and the battle that B'nai Yisrael fought in order to defend themselves, that's what took place on Yud Gimel Adar, in order to celebrate on Yud Dalet Adar. In Shushan, they needed an extra day, so the battle took place on Yud Dalet Adar in order to celebrate on Tesvav Adar. Right? So this is an entire year that we're talking about. So most of the first, chapter 1 and 2 happen before. Then we have 3, 4, 5, and 6, and 7 all take place in the matter of a couple of days, ending at Pesach time. Chapter 8, we're going to see, takes place in Sivan over the summer, and the war is in Purim time, right? It goes, takes 7-8 months. If that's the case, what in the world are they celebrating, and what's going on in the middle of Sivan? What's the missing part of the story? So that's chapter 8. And by the way, I looked around if anybody like had a long essay about this. Not so much is written on chapter 8. It's kind of like just out there. I think everybody's kind of exhausted from the first 7 chapters. And chapter 7 ends, verse 10, the last chapter is, Vayitlu es Haman al Eitz asher hichin leMordechai, that Haman is hanged on the tree that he had prepared for Mordechai. So Haman now is out of the picture at the end of chapter 7. So now we begin chapter 8. So I put out a link. I'll put it out again in case, right, that the if you want to just follow along, we're going to quickly read chapter 8 and just see what the words actually say. So chapter 8 says, where did I? Oh, there we go. So chapter 8 says, verse 1, right, by Yom Ahu, Nasana Melech Achashverosh. I'm even just going to skim it through. On that day, Achashverosh gives Esther the house of Haman, something, whatever that means, and Mordechai comes in front of the king because Esther had revealed who he is, right? Even though Achashverosh had given Mordechai this big celebration or this big reward of being rode around on the horse, right? So he didn't know his relationship to Esther. So now it's revealed. And the Yasar Melchis Tabato, and the king removes his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gives it to Mordechai. So Mephorshim actually make a comment here that we see, you know, there's a whole argument as to what exactly is Achashverosh's role in the story. Is Achashverosh evil? Is Achashverosh like this innocent bystander? Is he a front man? Is he, right? What exactly is his role? So some point to this pasuk as Achashverosh doesn't really care that he just as easily gave the ring to Mordechai as he had given it to Haman earlier. And there's more indications over the course of this chapter that Achashverosh is not necessarily so concerned with exactly what's going to happen. So let's continue on. So now, Vatosef Esther v'tedaber lifnei ha-melech. Now Esther now speaks to the king again. Vatipol lifnei raglav, and falls at his feet. It makes this big request from him. That she's crying and wants to avert the evil plan that Haman had enacted. Now, huh? I could have sworn that Haman just died 3 psukim earlier, right? What is Haman still doing in this part of the story? So, and what does the king do? So verse 4 is the king puts out his scepter, right, which we've learned about earlier. And Esther says if it's good in the eyes of the king, and if he sees it's okay, he should send out svarim about that which Haman had intended to do. Meaning all those letters that were sent out, so he should send out a letter saying that, get rid of that plot of Haman. Why? And we actually, it's strange because the next verse, verse 6, we read in the Eichatrap, we read in the slow morning dirge. But she says, how could I bear that my people will be killed? That I'm going to lose my nation. And I'm wondering, well, wait a second, I thought Haman is dead. I thought the whole problem is solved already. Why are we still concerned about this in chapter 8? So now it continues. So the king says to Esther and Mordechai, he may be Haman. I already gave you the base of Haman, and he's hanging, right? But he had tried to do this thing against the Jews. I already killed Haman for trying to do that. But now you want to write. Now you can write to the Jews. Or you can write about the Jews as you see fit, and you could put my seal on it. Because anything that is written and sealed with the ring of the king, it can't be rescinded. And that kind of is the key to understanding what in the world is going on here. That yes, it's true that Haman is dead, but the order had already been given, and the order had already been stamped and approved by the king. And there's some kind of Persian rule that once the king says something, it can't be backtracked on. It's over. It's done. It's sealed. And Ahasuerus had already authorized and authorized the destruction of the Jewish people. So now all of a sudden to say, well, Haman's dead. I guess it all goes away. Well, it wasn't Haman's command. It was Ahasuerus's command. And, oh, okay, so let's say so Ahasuerus can back down. Ahasuerus can't back down. He's not allowed to do that. And that's because once the king makes an order, so that order is going to have to be followed through on. But he says, look, you guys could send out your own letters. I'll seal it, or use my seal, and we'll see what happens. So now they did figure out what their letters are. So they call the sofrim of the king. When? And here we go. B'chodesh ha'shlishi u'chodesh Sivan b'shoshev yasirim bo. In the third month in Sivan, which is the 23rd day of the month, and what are they? And they send it out with the... And they send it out via Hashtar Panim v'Hapachos, right, to all of the to all of the rulers and governors and all the people from and he also wrote something separate to the Jews also in their own script. And what did they write? And they sent these svarim biar haritzim basusim on the people carrying the horses, that they could ride the horses, bnei haramachim that were bred in the royal stud, meaning that the royal horses were used for this passage. Now there are those who make a comparison between what happens in this parak versus in the third chapter, where the same thing is, a lot of the same language is there about sending out letters. So the Malbim points out that they didn't send, they were only sent regular messengers. They didn't do this thing with the horses and getting the fancy horses and getting the, you know, getting the king's fancy horses. That didn't happen. And part of that was because of the urgency, and they kind of wanted to demonstrate the urgency, right? They wanted to say that, that this is going to, so to speak, carry over the first letter that went out. And what did it say? Asher nasan la yudim asher liv elikai elva modan lafsham, that the king has permitted all the Jews to assemble and to fight. Lashmigla rogas kochel amun lunar atzrim otam tafin ashim, and exterminate its arm for when whoever fights against them, the women, the children, everybody could fight. Ushalam lavoz, and also to plunder their possessions. Why did they need to plunder their possessions? So the Malbim also says there that he didn't really want, that wasn't really part of what Mordechai cared about, but this was all part of instilling fear, that the Jews are going to be able to fight back. And when is that going to take place? And that's going to take place on the 13th day of the 12th month. So while they have one letter saying they're allowed to take on the Jews on the 13th of the 12th month, on Adar, now there's another letter saying, yeah, but the Jews are going to fight back. And they have every right to assemble, get an army together, and fight back. And that's what happens. It's put together. It was publicly displayed. Everybody knows. And Pasuk 14, Haratzin, the people, they took it out, that the decree was proclaimed in Shushan. And then Mordechai comes out. It's a little bit of an odd pasuk here. Mordechai comes out wearing the beautiful garments of being the king. So that perhaps emphasized, at least to the people in Shushan, that, yeah, but Mordechai is in charge. And, you know, yes, it's true. Haman had said you guys could fight against the Jews. But look, you know, you're going to be fighting against Mordechai. And Mordechai is wearing the clothing of the king. And at that point, just from seeing Mordechai on the 23rd day of Sivan, the Jews were at light and gladness and happiness and honor. And in every nation, in Pasuk 17, all over the country or the empire, the Jews were thrilled. They had a celebration and a Yom Tov. on the 23rd of Sivan, right? This isn't Purim. This is the 23rd of Sivan. V'rabim ayaretz misyahadim ki nafal pachad ayudim alihem. And many of the people of the land converted because of the fear and dread of the Jewish people had fallen upon them. Okay? So that is the pasuk. All of that thrilling excitement of the Jews celebrating and everybody being afraid and everybody converting takes place in Sivan while there is still a bounty over the Jews' heads. Right, there's still a command to kill the Jews, but yet the Jews are thrilled, and everybody is afraid of them. The proof being that what? That they all converted because they were afraid of the Jews. So, but yet the battle takes place five psukim later, or three psukim later. It's in the next parak that the sons of Haman are hanged, and that the battle is fought all over the empire, and then Shushan, and the Jews are victorious, and only then is the holiday declared as being a celebratory day for forever and ever. So what's going on? What is this big celebration? What is the La'yehudim Haisa Orav V'Simcha? What is that joy that took place in the beginning of Sivan? So that's just take a few moments to focus on that. So in Rav Soloveitchik's, in the book, Days of Deliverance, which is collects Rav Soloveitchik's essays about Hanukkah and Purim. So Rav Soloveitchik, his jumping off point is not the entire, not just the challenge of the story, but just the very beginning. When now Esther appears in front of Ahasuerus, and the description is that she falls on his feet and she cries and she's is full of sorrow and begs, and ultimately Ahasuerus listens to her, right? So the Rav Soloveitchik just draws a contrast. That's not what Moshe looked like when he appeared in front of the king, right? When Moshe comes in front of Paro, Moshe doesn't bow down and cry and pull on his shoes, right? That's not what happens. Moshe gets in and says, "Excuse me, we're going to go, right? And if you don't let us go right now, we're going to do enough bad things to you that you're eventually going to want to let us go." Right? Moshe never had that, that issue. And Rav Soloveitchik takes that to mean that and builds the idea that that's part of why we don't say Hallel on Purim, because the Jews are not necessarily in a better place at the end of the story than they were at the beginning of the story. Nothing changed. They're still stuck in Persia. They still have a king that is, we could say, ambivalent to them. At where we don't, other than the fact that they were saved, right? The entire Megillah could just be taken out, and it would be the same situation that the Jews are in now. Yes, it's true. Esther is there. Esther is in the palace, and perhaps that has ramifications later on as well. But Rav Soloveitchik suggests that part of the celebration of Purim is also the celebration of our insecurity, that we have a connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that it requires us to Daven. It requires us to continue to ask and to request and to beg and to and continue to develop that relationship, as opposed to Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. Those are holidays in front of Hashem, and the holiday of Pesach is when, you know, we're out of Egypt and we're out of Egypt for good, right? It's all over. It's done. We've had our geula. Purim is not about the geula. Purim is partly about a tefillah, and in fact the tour, which is the sort of the starting point for Ashkenazi halacha, the Torah records a minhag going back to the period of the Gaonim that they actually said Tachnun on Purim. Right, Purim, the day of joy, they also would say Tachnun, because Purim is about a day of joy for what we've achieved, but also a day of fear and insecurity about the future, and also and therefore a request and a request that we be taken care of going forward, and having having Tachnun and Purim on the same day, apparently according to them, is not a contradiction, right? That both of them fit together. It's a little harsh. I don't know. Like I was like, I'd like a little bit more joyful. So the question somewhat is, what exactly are we celebrating on Purim? And again, especially because La'yehudim Haisa, what exactly, what is the joy of La'yehudim Haisa Ora V'Simcha V'Sasun V'Yikar? That the Jews were thrilled just at the ability to be able to assemble and be able to fight back, to be able to have a war back. So I was thinking this myself, but it happened to be in Shul. He appeared at the HaMizrahi magazine, which has Divrei Torah from all over, many in Eretz Yisrael, including some not in Eretz Yisrael. And it actually has a section of 10, it goes through, has a page per chapter. It actually has a different person writing about each chapter. And so I was like, this morning, I picked it up. I said, I wonder if there's anything about chapter 8. And I found in here from Rabbi Yuval Chirlau, this idea that yes, it's true that Haman was the catalyst, but Ahasuerus had agreed. So Ahasuerus, and you can even read it as Ahasuerus saying, look, what do you want me to do? The law is the law. And as he puts it, the wanton hide behind the letter of the law. I mean, I can't step up. I can't do it. I can't back down. Right? The letter went out. But here's an eighth of what you guys can do if you figure that out. So what did Mordechai and Esther think to themselves? They said, well, right, we don't have a way of saving ourselves. The only thing we could do is to make sure it's clear that we're able to defend ourselves. So that's what they did. They sent that letter out, and they said, okay, we're going to, we're gonna defend ourselves. We're gonna defend ourselves. That's what we're going to do. So the way he describes it is, so that led to 9 months of suspense, right? It's now June, and we're waiting for March to come, right? And this battle, like there are these dueling orders out there. One order is saying that everybody, you should go and kill the Jews. Another order is saying the Jews are going to defend themselves. And nobody knows what's going to be, right? All the, on the cable news shows, there was countdown clocks and, first to the months and how many days left, how many minutes left, right? And everybody's waiting with anticipation until we're going to get to Adar. But he suggests, Rabbi Chirlau suggests, that even though in the beginning it was a little bit of a question as what's going to be, as the time went on, it became clear that B'nai Yisrael, the Jews, were getting organized, they were getting themselves together, and they were going to be able to mount a defense. To the point that all these non-Jews are like, oh gosh, we better I want to be on their team, because they're going to be the winning team. Right? And that's what led to the conversions or attempted conversions or suggested conversions, a lot of different interpretations as to what that means that all these people converted. But that's what led to that the B'nai Yisrael was not, that it became clear that B'nai Yisrael was going to win. But what do we learn from our chapter? I'll read from Mary Sherlau. What do we learn from our chapter? The ability to defend oneself is itself a great privilege. It's not self-evident, right? And Megillah says that the Jews lacked this ability until those letters were issued. So their reality was threatening and truly terrifying, bringing about fasting and mourning and the trials and tribulations until we got to the point to be able to defend themselves. So, but just the ability to defend oneself, that itself is a great privilege to which the Jews were not always entitled to over our many years of exile. So I started thinking that, what is, when we think about in our modern era, so the celebration of Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel Independence Day, what happened on Israel Independence Day? What happened on Hei Iyar of that year? Or I forget if it's Dalet Iyar, I think Dalet Iyar, because it was, what was that? The declaration was that we are now going to establish a state. Right, we're now go and what was the knowledge? Now there were attacks before that, right? The destruction of the caravan that was trying to replenish the Etzion block, right? There was already some fighting going on, but as soon as Israel declared a state, they knew that they would be invaded by all those other by all the Arab armies, by four armies, by five armies, etc. And there was a big debate going on as to what's going to be. And there's two things that I think just sort of recognize this tension. Number one is a couple of days before is when they decided that they were going to declare independence, that Ben-Gurion gathered together his cabinet and laid it out saying, the Americans had suggested a 3-month truce, but they thought if we push it off 3 months, it's going to be pushed off forever. We're never going to be able to declare it. And Ben-Gurion wanted to get to statehood, and he looks around at his cabinet and he knows it's close. It's a tight vote as to whether they're going to, knowing that they're going to go to war. And the story, there's different versions to the story, but Golda Meir had gone to Jordan to try to get very secretly, hid herself as an Arab, and it got snuck in to meet the king of Jordan, who she had a relationship with. And she and the king of Jordan made some kind of offer to her. She said, "We can't take that offer." But Golda Meir had said, "You know, you had told me that you might not attack us." And the king of Jordan said, "Yeah, but I have no choice because all the other Arabs are going to attack you, so I'm going to have to attack you." And Golda Meir said, "Look, you know, you attack us, we're going to fight you to the death, and we're going to win." And the Jordan's kind of, the king said, "You know, we'll see," right? And that was it. And Golda Meir left, got back into her car. Took her all night to travel back and eventually made it to this meeting, which was taking place on Tuesday, right? Declaration was on Friday. He made it at least on Tuesday. And she walks in and hands a note to Menachem Begin, David Ben-Gurion, saying that that we met. He's very lucky. He's very worried he's going to look bad. He doesn't deny that we've had talks, but at least he says he's one of five, and he's not going to be able to, you know, but now he's one of five, implying that he's going to fight against us. And there's different versions to the story. One version I heard is that Ben-Gurion read the note or had Golda Meir read the note. Another version of the story that I heard is that Ben-Gurion read the note, put it in his pocket, and didn't say anything about it to anybody there. That's the other version. But either way, it was a tight vote. Eventually it won, I think, 5-4, that they decide we're going to declare statehood. And that was that. So Ben-Gurion at his, you know, his proudest moment that day when he made the declaration on that Friday afternoon. So Shimon Peres records that night he was sort of like he was a young man at that point, but he was an aide to Ben-Gurion, and he recalls Ben-Gurion walking around. And remember, you see when they declare the state, if you look whenever you see the documentaries of it, all you see are people dancing in the streets and horas and jumping on cars and waving flags and everybody's exciting. And Peres describes Ben-Gurion that night where he says that Today they're dancing, but tomorrow there's going to be blood. Tomorrow there's going to be a war. And kachava, there was going to be a war, and that war lasted for 9 months. But yet the celebration is the beginning of the war. The celebration is that now we celebrate the beginning of the war when we had the opportunity to be able to fight. So I was wondering, like, wow, is there any significance to that? So I found, so Rav Schechter, in his article, in Be'ikvei Hatzon, his article where he sort of spells out his understanding of the modern state of Israel and what halachic status he has. So at the very end of that article, he points to a Gemara in Maseches Megillah, that the Gemara in Megillah asks a question when we think about our davening, our Shmona Esrei. So the first three brachos are the first three brachos. Then we ask for knowledge. Then we ask for, what's next? We ask for tshuva, and then we ask for, I'm missing one. What's next? I can't believe I'm on the spot here. Why we ask for knowledge, and we ask for. Come on. I don't know if it's Siddur Ami. Okay, but the seventh bracha, the Gemara points out, is the bracha of Geula. Is the bracha when we request the redemption. And asks the Gemara, why, and then what's the eighth bracha? The eighth bracha is the request for healing. So the Gemara asks, you know, if we're building up, you know, the request for healing would take place before the request for redemption. And the Gemara says, so why is it that the request for redemption is the seventh bracha before the blessing for healing? So the Gemara tells us, this is Maseches Megillah, Yud Zayin Amud Bey, 17b, Amar Rava, Mitoch Shasidim Ligael B'Shvias. Because eventually the Geula is going to come in the seventh year. What is that seventh year? What's it referring to? So the Gemara, Rashi explains that the Gemara in Sanhedrin relates that there's going to be a 7-year period before the period of Mashiach. And it's going to be difficult times. The first year is going to be famine. Other years are going to have other things. And the seventh year is going to have a great war. And then Mashiach is going to come. So the Gemara says, why is it that it's the seventh bracha? Baruch Rava says, because we're going to have our geula in the seventh year. So therefore they establish in the seventh bracha. So the Gemara asks, but wait a second. V'amar mar b'shishas kolos. Right? He said in the sixth year, you're going to hear sounds. And the seventh year is going to be war. And b'motzi shvius ben David ba. It's only after the seventh year that Mashiach is going to come. To which the Gemara responds by saying, milchama nami aschalta d'gu'ulihi. That the war itself could count as the beginning of the redemption. And Rav Schachter concludes his essay about the founding of the State of Israel that, yes, it's that many raised the question, earlier people, he quotes from the Minchas Elazar and, the Chassam Sofer, this is before, not specifically talking about the founding of Yom HaTzma'ut, but they said that, you know, the it makes sense that you would celebrate the day after when it's over, when the war is won. I mean, when the final ceasefire of the War for Independence happened, that's when we should have the celebration, according to the Torah. And where do we see that? Like by Hanukkah. The story of Hanukkah, the celebration of Hanukkah, is after the war is won, right? Sukkot was a challenging time. They were fighting for that period, during that period. And they found the Pach Shemen, they found the oil in the beginning of Hanukkah, which is after the war. So why is it that we celebrate Hanukkah after the war? And now, Purim is celebrated after the war, right? But the Lahudim Hais, what was the celebration in the Megillah that took place before the war? So perhaps, or Schachter isn't talking about Purim, he's just talking about Yom HaTzma'ut. He says, because when it comes to the Beis HaMikdash is celebrated when it's completed. But when it comes to Am Yisrael, when it comes to the nation, and it comes to the nation being able to defend themselves, that itself is the cause for the celebration. And he suggests that's what the Gemara in Maseches Megillah means when it says that the beginning of the war is the beginning of the Geula. Because even that ability to just to be able to fight, just to be able to defend ourselves, just to be able to proudly be able to to work with one another as a Jewish people and defend ourselves as Jews, that itself was the cause of celebration. So it was the cause of celebration not so long ago, 80 years ago already at this point, right? It was also a celebration during the time of period. And that perhaps gives us a better understanding as to the Megillah, right? It wasn't all in one spot. Haman dies Pesach time. Bnei Yisrael is not even happy about it until summertime. But yet there's still this fear that was going to carry them on throughout the entire year until ultimately they were going to able to be victorious in their battle. But but even just the ability that they were going to have to be able to assemble and to fight, that itself was a cause for celebration, which brought about the one of the most famous psukim of the Megillah, Yehudim Haisa Ora V'Simcha V'Sosam Yikar, that they had light and they had joy and they had happiness, and may the ultimate day of Yehudim Haisa Ora V'Simcha V'Sosam Yikar come very soon. So I wish everybody a Chag Sameach, Chag Purim Sameach. Look forward to seeing many of you. I'll look forward to maybe not seeing some of you, but not forward, but we'll miss some of you. And I wish everybody a Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.